council then provided the funds necessary to very expensive.
Stephon Clark! 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 Stephon Clark!
Can we all stand for a second? Can we all stand for a second, people? Everybody, take out your cell phone. Direct the cell phone to the council. Point it at the council. Does this look like a gun?
Just some of the scene at last night's city council meeting in Sacramento as anger continues to grow over the police shooting of a 22-year-old, Stephon Clark. The mayor adjourned that council meeting early as crowds gathered inside and outside. Protesters also blocked fans from entering a Sacramento Kings NBA game for the second time in a week. Stephon Clark was killed by police last month in his grandmother's backyard. Officers thought he was a robbery suspect and armed with a gun. He only had a cell phone. Joining us now is Betty Williams. She's the president of the Sacramento branch of the NAACP. And thank you so much for being here.
Oh, no worries. Thank you for keeping the message out there. I appreciate it.
Well, as we just heard, community members interrupted city council meetings and they blocked cars from getting into the stadiums. What's it like now to be in the Capitol? Are the protests front and center?
They are front and center. What you see right now are people that are hurting, and they're tired, and they're angry. And collectively, you get this type of result. And so, and they're grieving at the same time. So it's high charged right now because you have a lot of hurting people that's just tired of police shootings of unarmed black men.
As you say, it's high charged, and reportedly officers involved in the shooting have received death threats.
That the officers have received death threats? Is that what you said?
Yes. That's being reported. What did you know anything of that?
I did not. This is my first time hearing that. And I've been part of a lot of meetings, a lot of consultations that included the mayor's office and the chief of police, but this is my first time hearing this.
Well, Stephon Clark's brother made a very powerful statement in the clip that we just heard, and he was leading that chant of his slain brother's name. What else is his family saying about their son's death and what they want to see happen?
Well, I don't know if you've seen the press conference that we hosted earlier this week on Monday, and I think the grandmother said it all. Everyone has their way of grieving and processing this horrific crime, but they're hurting. They still can't believe it. You think you are safe in your grandmother's backyard. And a lot of them said that last night. We grew up in our communities where we could play in grandma's backyard. That was our security blanket, grandma's backyard, but not to die in grandma's backyard. And so when you look at Stavante, who was at City Hall last night, and you look at the grandmother who shared her story on Monday, in both cases, you may see it differently, but you see that they're hurt, they're grieving, they're sad, and they're angry.
Well, the Attorney General's office is now involved in leading the investigation. What do you think of that? What expectations do you have from their involvement?
I do have great expectations because the Attorney General and I have met before when there was a bill out there, and I don't know the name of the bill, but I do know that Assembly Member Kevin McCarty carried it at the time, where we were asking for them to have oversight with the AG. So when situations like this happen, that police would not be investigating themselves and we would have a third eye, and that third eye would be at the state level with the AG. I'm hoping with through NAACP we can bring that bill back, because during that time they gutted it and made it a research bill, and it's something that the Attorney General was behind as far as getting it gutted. So with that being said, I'm glad that he stepped up to the plate, but even with that, my understanding is that Chief Hahn went to him. It wasn't initiated. And the local NAACP have asked the FBI to get in, to get involved with the investigation as well, in addition to the Attorney General. And we have reached out to Department of Justice to get involved in this case.
Well, you have a lot of experience with this. This isn't the first case of an African-American being shot holding a cell phone, right? There's a similar story from 1997.
Right. I quoted that last night. You must have read. I gave the history to Sacramento for those who hadn't been around, that 1997, I think it was Fildebel, I'm pronouncing his name wrong, but he had actually initiated the call to the police. It was a domestic violence, him and his wife, and he was outside being emotional, beating up his own car. And so when the police pulled up, the short story is when the police pulled up, they said, hands up. And he had a cell phone in his hand, and they shot him dead. And so we have gone through this, the Mann case, and in 2007, the NAACP was instrumental in making sure we felt that we were being racially profiled as a city and demanded a study to validate or not. And in 2007, they validated that we were being racially profiled. So from 1997 to 2018, it's 21 years, what has happened that's different? And so that's my charge to the chief, to the mayor, the city council. We can't do the same things expecting a different result.
And what are you calling for to be done specifically to keep this from happening again?
What I'm specifically, what NAACP is asking for, the protocol and policies of the body cams, especially when it comes to the audio. What's the protocol in turning off the audio? If you're truly talking full transparency and trust within our community, there should not be a reason for you to turn off the audio. So we want to look at those protocols and policies and strengthen them so this won't happen again. We're also looking at the foot pursuit policy. And the things that I'm telling you now, we told Chief Hahn last Thursday when we met with him, that we're looking at the foot patrol policy in Oakland, where there are other options such as bringing in the dogs or going in and creating a perimeter to corner him, because since he had so much support that was coming his way, or a taser. There's using so many other resources versus lethal force that took the life of Stephon Clark. So we're looking at that, and we're looking at the training that they have, and if their training does include implicit bias, because we're at the feeling that implicit bias comes about fear, and we feel that police officers are fearful of African Americans. And how can you protect something that you are afraid of?
Well, it's a huge conversation. We have to keep it going, but unfortunately, we have to end this one. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Betty Williams, president of the Sacramento branch of the NAACP. Turning to immigration now, a new proposal from the Trump administration could deny U.S. residency to immigrants who have ever used almost any form of public benefits, including popular tax breaks. Current rules can ding immigrants looking for permanent status who collect cash benefits or needed long-term care at government expense. Under the new measures, if approved, caseworkers would look at other benefits to disqualify applicants, including the earned income tax credit or health insurance subsidies. And it would take into account benefits received by an immigrant's children, even if they're U.S. citizens. So to walk us through the details of this plan and what it means, I'm joined by Dara Lind. She's an immigration reporter for Vox.
Hi.
You reported on a proposal like this, I noticed, almost 2 months ago. But now I think the plan seems to have undergone some changes and become even more far-reaching. So how has it changed, and what's the rationale here from the Trump administration?
Sure. So this is because all of this, we know based on documents that have leaked, the version that, you know, the Washington Post reported on today is a later draft of a leaked version than what Reuters and I reported on a month ago. So the rationale is kind of there. What we're seeing is less them making the rationale for making particular changes than just kind of
what the results of their internal deliberations are. And so far, it looks like they reacted to the backlash from the, you know, initial proposal coming out in February by expanding the list of things that could be used to count against immigrants who are applying for green cards, by adding, say, the earned income tax credit, which had not been included in the prior version of the regulation. And possibly, and this is the really weird thing in here, even though this is a close to final version of the regulation that they're expected to publish in the Federal Register sometime this year, there's still this big insert text question about deporting immigrants for using social services that would make them a public charge.
Insert text? This is a 223-page proposal,
yes.
And yet there's an insert text in there.
So a lot of the 223 pages is kind of the rhetorical justification, the technical language that the government has to go through when explaining any change to a regulation, assessments of how much this is likely to cost, what benefits it's likely to have, and kind of this just hortatory rhetoric about how bad it is for immigrants to use social services. So the actual regulatory text itself is a lot shorter, but it is definitely strange that for such a huge question as what can make an immigrant who is here legally deportable, they haven't figured that out yet. And that's really worrisome to immigration lawyers.
Well, just quickly, and obviously it's not a finished proposal yet, but how likely is it that this version would get approved?
Because regulatory provisions are entirely the administration's, you know, bailiwick, it's very hard to imagine that whatever is published in the Federal Register won't ultimately be approved. There will, however, be a period for public comment, so there will be an opportunity for some of the people who have been expressing concerns about this to have their say. There's just no obligation to listen to them.
Well, I want to bring someone else into the conversation. Rajiv Khanna is a U.S. immigration lawyer and a member of the Washington, D.C. and Virginia bars. And welcome to the show, Rajiv.
Thank you.
So what we've just heard from Dara, judging on that, how much of an impact do you imagine would these changes have on the people that you work with who are trying to get a green card?
How much time do we have?
give your best shot.
All right. Let's begin, first of all, with a reflection, a clear reflection of bias in the regulations themselves. If you look at the page 129, it says, we don't know whether immigrants are taking away from public fisc or giving to the public fisc. Okay, you say that very clearly. Then what is the need for these regulations, other than to create and heighten that invisible wall, which Washington Post reported on a few weeks ago, saying that Trump is creating an administrative wall, an impossibility for legal immigrants to make it into the United States. So if you don't need them, why do you have them? Number one. Number two, it is interesting to note on page 88 of these regulations, they say, well, census data shows that people who speak, now this is really, really odd. I speak three languages in my home, and I do speak reasonably good English. This regulation says people who speak language other than English in their homes are less likely to be gainfully employed and are likely to be employed at salaries less than routine salaries for those positions. Now, because of that, English speaking ability is a determination that must be a part of the overall determination on whether or not somebody is going to become a charge on the public fisc. Now, to me, these are sort of giveaways. These are little things, little tells that speak to us about the administrative mindset.
Well, listen, what advice are you giving your clients then?
I'm telling them, thank God we have courts.
Okay. Elaborate.
We intend to go to court a lot. We are actually setting up an entire network of lawyers and law firms where every provision that exceeds the boundaries of law, and there are a lot of them, we will end up knocking on the doors of the courts. And all of these provisions that are so unreasonable are not only likely to be reversed, we will get our attorneys fees from court because there is something called Equal Access to Justice Act, which allows courts to give us attorneys fees so that our clients are not overly burdened every time the government is not substantially justified in administrative adjudications. That's the first thing. Second thing, these regulations, when you look at these regulations, I want to take just 1 minute and sum up for you some of the things that they are doing.
You can have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Regulations say we can look into your health. We can look into your credit reports. And we are going to look into your credit reports to see whether you're going to become a charge on the public fisc.
But look, are you telling them not to take health insurance subsidies or not to do some of these things that are outlined in these 223 pages?
These regulations are not yet published. If they try to affect them retroactively, that is unconstitutional. Some of it we can challenge in courts as unconstitutional. Ex post facto laws are forbidden.
Dara, turning back to you, what is the bigger picture?
That it won't be retroactive.
It won't be, right. Well, what's the bigger picture here? Do you see this as a kind of mission creep? Because the RAISE Act aimed to cut legal immigration by half when Trump announced it back in August, and he said he doesn't want immigrants on welfare. So this seems to be a new kind of extension of that.
So this is actually something that the Trump administration was considering in its very first week in office. It was an executive order that was leaked but never actually signed by the president. So we know it's been in their sights for a while. I think the real question is, do they see this as part of a propaganda war to kind of push the idea that immigrants are draining, you know, the American coffer and using welfare and therefore are bad for America? Or do they see it as a real way to force USCIS, government employees to be much more restrictive in who they're letting stay in the country and giving green cards to? Because a lot of this is going to be based on the discretion of individual employees, we really won't know until this actually goes into effect whether this is mostly a rhetorical tool or something that's going to have a very big impact.
Dara, thank you very much. Dara Lindt, immigration reporter at Vox. Also, Rajiv Khanna joined us. Thank you, Rajiv. And Rajiv is with immigration.com. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, single-payer health care got shot down last year in Sacramento, but one Silicon Valley man is championing a ballot initiative for it. We're going to hear about an unlikely and controversial solo quest for guaranteed health care for all Californians. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave and from Madeline Brand. Now an unlikely player in the fight for universal health care. His name is Dale Fountain. He's 42 years old, and he works in the tech industry. After the November election, he started a Facebook group to advocate for a single-payer system in California. He's done some lobbying, and now he's working on a ballot initiative that would change state funding rules to make a single-payer system feasible. But for someone so engaged in such a high-profile issue, Dale Fountain is a very private guy. So Pauline Bartoloni is here to tell us about him. She is a correspondent for Kaiser Health News and California Healthline, and it's good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
So who is Dale Fountain? What's known about him besides what I just reeled off?
Well, Dale Fountain calls himself just an average guy. He's very private, as you said, so it's hard to get details about him. He's uncomfortable with the spotlight, and that's to put it mildly. He lives in Silicon Valley, works in the tech industry, and after the 2016 election, he was really concerned that the Republican administration was going to roll back health care in California, so he created this Facebook group called Enact Universal Healthcare in California. It has quite a following. Over 100,000 people now follow it, and he's been very engaged in the debate about creating universal health care in California, particularly single-payer. And so that's a program in which, you know, the government would administer health care and publicly fund it for everyone.
Do you know why he's so passionate about this issue?
He definitely has strong political convictions. He says that he's tired of seeing people, hearing stories about people not going to be able to afford health care, not being able to afford their medical bills once they come out of the hospital. He says most developed nations take care of their citizens as far as health care, and he doesn't understand why the U.S. doesn't do it. His friends say that he's kind of a practical guy. He just likes to solve problems. His sister speculates that maybe it has something to do with their mom dying. When Dale was a toddler, she died of breast cancer, and it sounded like it was pretty hard going for them.
Huh, so maybe a lot of things contributing to this. What exactly does this ballot initiative call for?
Fountain's group is trying to get something called the California Healthcare Roadblock Removal Act on the ballot. They're collecting signatures right now. And basically, that wouldn't fund single payer in and of itself, but it would amend the Constitution to make it easier to raise those funds. So a government-run system would most likely need to raise significant tax revenues. We're talking about like at least $200 billion a year. So the way the Constitution is written, California wouldn't be able to raise those revenues easily, even if lawmakers agreed to raise those significant taxes.
And that's the operative thing, right? State lawmakers shot this single payer down last year. So why does he think he even has a chance with this ballot initiative? And why go forward if the legislature isn't supporting this?
You know, he says eventually lawmakers are going to have to face this issue of creating a universal health care system. And so down the road, if single payer is created, this ballot initiative would remove the roadblocks to raising money for any system like that, a publicly funded system.
So this is a long-term strategy.
It is. And California lawmakers are pursuing more incremental or baby steps for now. You know, they're considering expanding health care to undocumented immigrants or subsidies to make health care more affordable to people who buy insurance on their own. So a single-payer program is definitely years away in their mind.
Well, the California Nurses Association is a proponent of the single-payer system, and they did reach out to Dale Fountain to work with him, but apparently things went a little bit south, and they've been unhappy with him, and one of their spokespeople called him irrelevant to health care. Period.
Yeah.
So what's going on there?
They had pretty harsh words. Well, they disagree about what exactly happened. I mean, Dale Fountain says that the nurses had approached him after he created his Facebook group and that they were running their social media campaign for a while last year. And the nurses say, no, that never happened. He never worked with us. He was kind of taking advantage of our work on single payer. And the nurses have really made single payer their signature issue, and they were the sponsors of the stall bill right now in the legislature. So Dale Fountain says that he stopped working with them because of this this kind of technical question about whether or not funding single payer would need to go to the voters.
So we have some activism inside baseball here.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Now, Dale Fountain is pretty secretive, though. You did mention he's gotten a certain number of signatures so far, but he won't give exact numbers and he won't talk about how much money he's raised. Why this secrecy and the shyness from public scrutiny and from talking to the press?
I think he's just distrustful of media in general. Who knows? It could be that they haven't collected many signatures. It could be that he doesn't know exactly how many signatures they've gathered yet. What they're doing is an entirely volunteer effort. So he's using Facebook to get people to download the petitions and then get their friends to sign the petitions and then send them back to where he lives in Sunnyvale. And then they'll be submitted, theoretically, by the end of April, which is the deadline for his measure to get on the ballot. I tried to get a lot of answers from him. After a couple interviews, I was unsuccessful, and he wouldn't really talk to me about, he wouldn't answer certain questions. So,
well, moving forward, what are the proposals and prospects for healthcare reform in general? And, you know, the nurses called Dale Fountain irrelevant. Is he?
I don't think he's irrelevant. If you just look at his Facebook followers, you see that he's definitely engaging people, 100,000 people every day, at least online. And he's still trying to lobby lawmakers to get them to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot to make it easier to fund universal health care down the road. One lawmaker, Assembly Member Jim Wood, who chairs the Assembly Health Committee, he said that it makes sense to take it to the voters to try to remove some of these constitutional roadblocks, and reputable policy experts at the Capitol kind of endorse Fountain's efforts. So he seems to be onto something, according to healthcare experts, but it's definitely a long-term game.
Pauline Bartoloni, she's a correspondent for Kaiser Health News and California Healthline. And thanks so much for the conversation.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
Coming up, writer Steve Almond can't stop thinking about 2016.
There were 104 million registered voters who didn't even bother to exercise their franchise. That's 40 million more than either of the candidates got.
To explain what's gotten us here, he points to false narratives running deep in American literature and culture. Steve Almond on Bad Stories. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand.
Estimates are that Donald Trump received up to $5 billion in free media.
American cable news has a tradition of sensationalizing news stories. You saw that in particular with CNN over the course of the cycle and Fox News.
Attempting to turn out this disenfranchised vote of people who maybe haven't voted in the previous few elections, people who feel like the system's rigged and it's been against them.
Whichever side of the political spectrum you're on, it's probably something that everybody can agree on, is that he was certainly going to do something different, right?
Well, after the 2016 presidential election, a lot of people were trying to explain how a reality TV star and real estate developer had become president. One of them was author and Harvard journalism professor Steve Almond. The result of all his cogitating is a new book, Bad Stories: What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country? I think the title gives you a pretty good idea what side of the election Almond was on. Bad stories, Almond writes, about our representative democracy, the economy, about Obama and Clinton, and about Trump himself. Lots and lots of bad stories lead to a distorted view of what's really going on in the country. His book is an effort to unwrap and correct some of these stories. And Steve Almond joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, I just said the phrase bad stories about 100 times.
Yeah, well, so bad stories, I know, sounds super professional and sophisticated. It's like a real political science term, but I'm a kind of a recovering journalist. I was a journalist for a while, but now I'm mostly a short story writer and an essayist. But I think the central thing that I am is a storyteller, and I think that's how human beings construct their realities, their inner life and the world around them. I think it's how they kind of try to pluck meaning from the rush of experience. And I think that those stories can be, even if they're well-intentioned, and sometimes they're not well-intentioned, can be incredibly destructive. And they can also be redemptive. In the case of what's happening in America, I looked around and have been looking for the past few decades and just seeing a proliferation of really bad stories about who we are as a country, about the ways in which we should fear one another, antagonize one another, stories that are told either unintentionally or intentionally to sow discord, to distort reality because somebody has an agenda to make money or aggregate wealth.
Well, you also start with some stories from your own life, and you start the book with Watergate and your flashback to Watergate, that you remember Nixon resigning. That's something that most people think of as a bad story, Watergate, or at least a dark moment for the country, but you don't see it that way necessarily.
No, I think it's just a good story in general. So the story that people tell themselves about Watergate is, oh, politicians are all corrupt, and this corrupt politician brought the country down, and it was a disgrace, and it was terrible. It was a kind of a loss of faith. In fact, the story we should be telling is that a kind of idealism prevailed. Americans, individual Americans all across the political spectrum, were deeply troubled. that the elected leader was somebody who would abuse his power. There was a consensus that
a shared value system.
A shared value system.
And you saw that in your reaction, your mother's reaction, right, to Nixon resigning?
Yeah. We happened to be in Mendocino, California, in the house of a perfect stranger, a guy with a crew cut. I remember because I was like 7-year-old, 5-year-old hippie kid with long hair. And the only TV we could find, because we heard that Nixon was resigning, was in the house of this a neighbor of a friend of ours who was like had a crew cut. He'd voted for Nixon. He admitted this to us rather gallantly, I think, in a real sense of feeling that he had been betrayed personally, that a person who he thought was of integrity was really not. It was that commonly held feeling, Barbara, that all of us had been betrayed and that it was not acceptable for politicians to behave in this way that drove the media to pursue the story and that drove an increasing sense of moral distress that forced the even the Republicans in Congress to go to the president and say you're finished, we're not going to support you anymore, you have to leave office or you'll be forced to leave office. And I think that's a story about idealism. I think we're looking at it the wrong way and taking the wrong lesson from it.
And this focus on stories, I think it comes back to something that's proven, that there are many studies about how people react viscerally to candidates and stories about candidates, and that they react emotionally instead of thinking through policies that they support and how those policies might impact them. And after the election, you're left with so many questions about how can people vote against their best interests. And one of the best examples you give is a story about your friend Josh. Tell us why he voted for Trump and the conversation you had about that.
Well, actually, he didn't vote for Trump. He voted for the Libertarian candidates. But this is a guy who basically sort of had heard so much negative stuff about both candidates that he, you know, lodged a protest vote. But what's significant about that is that like 8 years ago, he had lost his job. And as a result of that, he was in real financial trouble. And he needed the help of the stimulus package, right, the American Recovery Act, to pay for his health insurance for his family. That was a measure that had been pushed through Congress, you know, with no support from Republicans. The Democrats had just barely been able to get that legislation passed. And it had appreciably helped save his bacon, if you know what I mean. It really helped his family in a moment of crisis. Well, 6 or 7 years later, this guy thinks it doesn't matter who gets elected. He was uninterested in any of the policy matters. And I don't think that makes him an exception. I think there are a lot of voters. There were 104 million registered voters who didn't even bother to exercise their franchise. That's 40 million more than either of the candidates got. And so, you know, we've got a kind of central crisis, which is we're not taking this amazing, glorious experiment in self-governance seriously. If you drill down, what all these stories share in common is people are exalting their grievances as a way of not having to face their vulnerability. And I think what writers do and what storytellers are trying to do is to make us aware that we all share certain vulnerabilities and that there's no shame in that. That's what requires us to sort of extend the bonds of human kindness. That's the redemptive power of stories, like religious stories, like the story of a homeless pacifist rabbi who preached the gospel of love as a revolutionary force. That's a beautiful story that says, you know, it's not the accumulation of wealth and power that really matters. What matters is that people are kind to one another and good to one another. I don't care whether that's a true story or not, factually. I think it's intended to make people more human, to allow their moral imagination to include other people's suffering as part of their responsibility. And you just don't hear that kind of story anymore. Certainly in American political life, the stories that dominate are stories of loathing, stoking of grievance. That's kind of the Trumpian mindset.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Steve Almond, author of Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country? So we can talk about a lot of these stories, but many of them are told by journalists. And you give journalism a lot of grief for being part of the problem of bad stories when it should be part of the solution, you write. So what's the news media doing wrong? And I should say, you point the finger at news outlets just on the whole political spectrum, from Mother Jones to NPR to Fox News.
Well, what I would say is that we as a culture, I mean, you get the media, the fourth estate in a capitalist society that you pay for, in a sense. So I don't want to stick it on journalists or journalistic organs because they are essentially serving the customer base. It redounds to individual Americans to turn away from stories that are about ultimately trivial scandals and that are all about kind of which team is winning, which tribe is more powerful, and towards the kinds of stories that are centered around trying to identify how we can solve common problems: climate change, income inequality, stagnation of wealth, special interests that have kind of come to dominate the policymaking organs in Washington. All of that stuff we can all agree abstractly matters, but I think as a rule, journalists are asking a basic question that is, will it stimulate? Or maybe the owners of media outlets are asking, will this stimulate? Will it generate clicks on behalf of the sponsors? How do we get people's attention in this frantic tabloid media environment? And I think that is a betrayal of the public service role that the Fourth Estate should serve. I put a lot of weight on something called the Fairness Doctrine, which I know sounds very esoteric, but it was the measure that government put in place when they realized that mass media was so powerful that it needed to be regulated. Because if, you know, our voices, we can reach a million listeners, 10 million listeners. A television station can reach 100 million viewers. And if they're telling bad stories, and if they're profiting by telling bad stories, that is not in the public's interest. It takes us further away from the truth of our circumstances and the possible remedies. And I think the Fairness Doctrine was put in place in order for the government to be able to say, no, you're not allowed to air propaganda 24/7. If we're going to have a debate about controversial issues, all shades of reasonable opinion should be included. You cannot just demagogue for 24 hours. And when that was taken away, you saw an incredible surge in partisan media, in particular right-wing radio, and then later Fox News. And that's created these kind of media silos where you can literally go through your entire day getting a version of reality that's deeply paranoid, conspiracy-minded, and not a true and accurate assessment of your circumstances or your country's circumstances. And when you have bad stories that proliferate in that way, you're going to get bad outcomes. Rather than looking at a piece of legislation and saying, oh, I see, they're trying to make healthcare a little bit more affordable for people who are low income, you instead get their death panels, and they're going to kill old people. They're going to euthanize, you know, people of a certain age. That's a false story, and yet that stoking of primal negative emotions becomes very profitable. But you know, media is not supposed to be entertainment. At a certain level, at least, the Fourth Estate is there to try to really be the people's representative in Washington. That's what it was doing in Watergate, if you think about it.
You know, I finished your book, and then I watched these students protesting in Washington.
Yes.
And we've had a lot of protests. We've had a lot of marches since Trump took office. A lot of political journalism that has been quite critical of him and quite on a fact-finding mission. So right. Where does that leave you after this 270 pages?
Yeah, believe me, I'm down in South Florida, and look, stories are powerful, and I'm interested in the soul of the thing. I know I can get sort of wound up, like a lot of people, about the particulars, but this is a book that's kind of aimed at the soul. Where's the soul in all this? And when you see young people in high school who have just suffered the trauma of, you know, being shot at sometimes, and certainly seeing classmates gunned down, and they're able to rise from that trauma and say, actually, we no longer consent to being objects of history. We're going to be the subjects of history. That's a beautiful story. That's a redemptive story. And the same thing is true of journalists who have redoubled their efforts to divine the truth and focus on what the policies of this administration and the Congress are aimed at. And it's true of the people, any people who march in any political protest. On all sides, what I hope is going to happen, because history does swing back and forth, right? There are periods of moral regression, and there are periods of great moral progress. And those are always incredibly inconvenient. The Civil War, you know, 60,000 souls were lost for this country to own up to slavery. And then there was Jim Crow, and it took a civil rights movement, and then a war on poverty. And, you know, the New Deal, none of these things have been easy. But the last story in the book is the idea that, you know, it's a bad story to say that moral improvement moral progress is impossible. It isn't impossible. It's inconvenient. It means we have to get up off of our couches and detach from our screens and our social media feeds, and we have to become active participants in democracy, supporting causes and candidates that we believe in on all sides of the political spectrum. That's what makes a healthy democracy that's trying to solve its problems. That's a story that these kids are trying to tell, that they're demonstrating right in front of our eyes, that they are rising up and saying, I am not going to be acted upon by history. I want to author my own story. And that's beautiful. That gives me a lot of hope. And I got to have a lot of hope because I got three kids who aren't even in middle school yet.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. And thank you, Steve. Thanks for all the stories.
Absolutely.
Steve Allman, he's the author of Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country. Coming up, two new exhibits at the Autry Museum tell the story of the long history of Chicano activism. Our arts reporter, Carolina Miranda, will tell you why you should head to Griffith Park to see them. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW Donation Car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Madeline Brand. At a time when the President of the United States regularly calls for building a wall to keep out bad hombres from Mexico, you don't have to go far to overhear stereotypes about Mexico or Mexicans. Two new exhibitions at the Autry Museum of the American West in Los Angeles are pushing back against that kind of typecasting. The shows explore Chicano identity by documenting activism, faith, community, and arts. LA Times staff writer Carolina Miranda is here to tell us all about them. She's a regular contributor here at Press Play, and she recently spoke with the artist and curator behind these exhibitions. And it's wonderful to have you here, Carolina.
Thank you for having me, as always.
So you spoke, as I said, to the artist Harry Gamboa Jr. and also the curator Luis C. Garza about the exhibits and Chicano identity. And I understand they both have had a long involvement in activism and Chicano culture. What do they have to say about Trump's rhetoric attacking Mexicans and Mexican Americans? I imagine that came up.
Yeah, well, they have a lot to say, probably more than we have time for in today's segment. But I think their exhibitions say it for them. And what you have are two exhibitions, one which is the archives from the activist newspaper La Raza, which was this very important activist Chicano newspaper from the 60s and 70s, curated by Luis Garza, who was one of the photographers there. And then in another gallery, you have the exhibition Chicano Male Unbonded, and that is by Harry Gamboa, who's a founding member of the very influential arts collective OSCO. And his show is a little bit more artful, a little bit more conceptually driven, and it is literally a map of all the Chicano men in his life who have had an effect on his life in some way. So his father, poets, playwrights, fellow artists, he photographs them at night from a lower viewpoint. So all of these figures in the gallery, these I think it's almost 90 photos that he has in there, are looking down at you when you walk in.
And I have a couple questions about that. First of all, why men?
I think for him, it started off with a night in the 1990s where he was driving home and he turns on the news radio and there was something like, you know, looking for a Chicano male, like some crime had been committed and the police were on the lookout for a Chicano male. And he thought about all of the stereotypes that that embodied. And he thought about all of the Chicano men in his life who were the opposite of those stereotypes, you know, speaking to Trump's stereotypes. That these were men who were accomplished, who had contributed to their country, who had contributed to their communities, who had contributed to the world of art and letters. And that's when he really decided to create this massive portraiture project that has been ongoing for more than 20 years, in which he records the men, the Chicano men in his life who've had an effect on his life.
And didn't he say somewhere he wanted it to look a little bit like film noirish?
Yes, he photographs them all at night. oftentimes with ambient light. So the photos are very dramatic. They're very cinematic. And he shoots them. He shoots the men from low. So he's looking up at his subjects. So the subjects are looking down at him. And he says that when you think of the stereotypical images of Mexican-American men in the media, if you think of the cholo, of the criminal, of the mugshot, of these kind of perspectives that we have, that these stereotypical perspectives, that he wanted something that was the opposite, that it was this idea of that you would walk into the gallery and these dozens of very accomplished Chicano men would be looking down on you.
Wow. Now, tell us about this other show, the show co-curated by Luis Garza, La Raza.
Yes.
And that, I think you might have said it, it's a 1960s era Chicano newspaper, La Raza.
Yes, it was an activist newspaper, so very closely tied into the Chicano civil rights movement, issues of equity, dealing with police brutality in that era, the Vietnam War, rights for the community, all those kinds of issues that we're facing Chicanos and Mexican Americans in the 1960s and 70s. And they have this vast archive of photography that the Chicano Studies Research Center, UCLA, has been digitizing. 26,000 photos.
I saw that number. It's mind-boggling.
It's
yeah.
absolutely mind-boggling. And so he sat down and pored through many of those thousands of images. And I think this is what's so impressive about the show is that it's a show drawn from an archive. And, you know, sometimes archive shows can feel a little bookish.
They can be a little snoozy.
Exactly. Like you feel like you're doing homework. And I think what Luis and the curators at the Autry have really accomplished with this exhibition is to make it super dynamic. And so the first thing they've done is rather than try to do like a chronological beginning to end show, they've set things up by theme. So there's family, there's protests, there's community, there's arts, there's, for example, the Chicano movement was very closely allied with the American Indian movement of the 1970s. There's photos from those types of events. So really distilling things down by theme to show the ways in which Chicanos in the Chicano community was being portrayed and the sorts of causes they were active in at that time. And then with a lot of very dynamic multimedia presentations. So some of the photos are very large and they lead to smaller clusters of photos. And if you're still interested beyond then, you can flip through screens.
Oh, that's why I love exhibits that kind of guide you through and there's a velocity to it or a change in pace.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you can kind of dip in as much as you're interested or not. If you just kind of want to see what's on the walls, you can cruise through and see that. If you really want to do a little bit more, you can look at the screens. And the screens are very important because a lot of these negatives, you know, over the years, they've been sitting in shoeboxes under people's beds and they're unlabeled. There's no captions. People don't always know who's in the photos. So part of the whole point of putting all of those images on the screens for people to access is that if you go and you see someone you know in one of those images, you can tag it and let the Chicano Studies Research Center know a little bit about what's going on in that photo. So it's an information gathering show as well.
And speaking of photos, photographs make up such a big part of both of these exhibits. And I'm thinking that's because La Raza, it's a magazine, newspaper, and activism focus. Or is it that photography holds such a central place in Chicano culture?
Well, I think it's important. It is important for a number of reasons to the Chicano movement and to Chicano art. And one is the time period. If you're looking at the 1970s, you know, 60s and 70s.
Pre-internet.
Exactly. Yeah. It's pre-internet. It's post-Vietnam War, which is when photography really began to get very portable. You know, people shooting with little 35-millimeter cameras. So it was more accessible than, say, shooting video or film or the other. When you think of the other kinds of mediums that would have been available at the time, photography was very accessible to a wide range of people. And I think it's a little bit of what Harry talked about is that, you know, there aren't a lot of depictions of Mexican Americans, period, in the media. It's a bit of a vacuum. So that's why someone like Trump can come in and fill that vacuum with a lot of stereotypes. And so for a lot of for the journalists of La Raza, but also artists like Harry, who were using art in much more like playful and conceptual ways, it's a way of filling that vacuum with their own narrative, of taking photography and using it as a tool almost a weapon to say, hey, we're not going to be defined by these photographs you see in the media. We are a million other things, too. We are not just, you know, cholos and gang members and criminals. We are artists and poets and activists and writers, you know.
And just in the last minute, how did Garza and Gamboa come to work with the Autry?
You know, that was it started off with the Pacific Standard Time series of exhibitions. The La Raza exhibition is part of the Pacific Standard Time series. It's actually one of the few shows now that is still left at the end of the series. So they had gotten funding from the Getty to do that show. And then, you know, God bless the Autry Museum. They decided that having the La Raza show started a conversation. And so by getting Harry's show to go with it, it was a good way to have this dialogue between art and journalism.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it. And thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, and she's a regular contributor here at Press Play. And Luis C. Garza's La Raza is up through February 10th of 2019, and Harry Gamboa Jr.'s Chicano Male Unbonded is up through August 5th of this year. They're both at the Autry Museum of the American West. And that'll do it for us for today on Press Play. Thanks for listening. I'm Barbara Bogave. I'll see you tomorrow.